Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Welcome and thank you for joining us. Our guests tonight are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Brendan Joel Kelly of the Anchorage Press, and Lynn Anderson of KSKA and APRN. Steve, Governor Sean Parnell announces his vetoes of the state budget, some $300 million plus. Tell us about the vetoes and what the governor said in explaining what he did.
Yeah, there were two budgets that he acted on, and everybody had been anxiously awaiting his decision on these budgets. Probably the more controversial of the two was the operating budget. It's an $8 billion spending plan for state agencies. He carved $3 million out of that budget, $3 million out of that budget, and most of that money was to go to expand Denali Kid Care. And that also drew the greatest response and the greatest negative response, public outcry from folks when he did that. A lot of politicians who are running for governor, especially the Democratic candidates, all slammed him for that, you know, balancing the budget on the backs of kids and, you know, that kind of thing. So that really elicited the biggest public outcry. Then he also cut $300 million out of the, I think it's a little over $3 billion capital budget that was approved by lawmakers. So that $300 million, that goes for construction projects all around the state of Alaska. Anchorage got dinged a little bit in there. The city had hoped to get some money to refurbish and make some corrections to the Sullivan Arena.
Steve, we might get in here. How did the Republican mayor of Anchorage take it?
He says I think Mayor Sullivan pretty much agreed with it. He was very happy with what the city did get. The issues, the projects that got cut, those are things that probably can be put on a ballot initiative at some particular point in time, should the city desire to do that. But I think most of the reaction from the Matsu Valley, as well as from Anchorage, was, okay, we're thankful for what we did get, and we're happy, and we can move on. There weren't many projects that he just completely cut out completely. He reduced a lot of money that was supposed to go to several projects, so those projects could continue on in some form. So,
in the operating budget, Brendan, Denali Kid Care became linked with abortion. How did that happen, and what did the governor have to say when he made the veto?
Well, two words for you, primary politics. candidate Parnell says that he just discovered, he had promoted the bill which raised the federal poverty level qualifications to get Denali Kid Care from 175% to 200%. He was behind it during the session, but he says he just discovered that it provides for medically necessary abortions, and so he vetoed it. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be quite accurate. In 1998, when he was in the Senate and was the co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee, a bill came up that would have restricted using state funding for medically necessary abortions. It did pass. It was cut down in the courts under the equal access laws. But so he was aware of it back then, but seems to have forgotten about it. And, you know, it's campaign season, and he had a chance to endear himself to the pro-lifers.
And his side of it is, once I knew that this money was in there, I just couldn't do it, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's stick with the abortion issue. The anti-abortion faction won a major victory in the Supreme Court. They'll be allowed to proceed with an initiative and the language of the initiative that they very much wanted in the primary coming up in August. Tell us about the initiative and what and the specifics of the court case.
Well, it's the Parental Notification Initiative, the PNI they call it, and it basically requires a doctor to, within 48 hours, notify a minor's parents that they are about to get an abortion. The Parental Consent Act was passed and failed a few years ago, failed in the courts. It was shot down as unconstitutional. They said, you know, maybe if you make it, the court said, if you make it notification. So they got the signatures for it. They got 36,000 signatures to get this on the ballot, this initiative on the ballot. And Planned Parenthood sued them for that and got a minor victory when they said, well, the summary language that you used wasn't clear that a doctor could be guilty of a felony and face prison time. And so, but they didn't take it off the ballot. So they went, Planned Parenthood took it to the Supreme Court and said, you know, the question on what people were signing on the petitions to get this on the ballot didn't include that. Why is it okay for this to proceed on the ballot when you said that it was, it shouldn't have been there in the first place? But the Supreme Court said that the Constitution says that initiatives should be construed liberally. That was the words that the Supreme Court used. And so as long as they correct the language on the summary that will actually be on the ballot that you see on August 24th, then the initiative will be there.
Okay, thank you. Let's move ahead to Len Anderson. We'll skip ahead to Len Anderson. Len, welcome. You did a show recently, or a story, on summer school here in Anchorage and how important it's become to our community. Why don't you tell us about the story and some of what went into making it?
Well, this is a particular group of summer school classes. There are the regular ones operating under the Anchorage School District directly. And then there is another cluster that comes under Title VII Indian Education. That's department within the school district, but somewhat separate because it comes under the federal act. And they have really bolstered their summer school presentations to keep the kids in school, to advance them academically. And they've got five different programs this summer. That's the most they've ever had.
One. Do we know yet how many young people are involved in the program?
Well, in the first one, the enrichment program, that's for grades 1 through 8, which includes some general studies, including physical education, but also cultural music, and three different native languages, Alaska Native languages. Those are two-week sessions with 150 students in each. Then there is another one for the 9 through 12 group, which will actually be ongoing, and I have to check my pronunciation here, which will only be approximate. Project Bohituk means smart person in Chupik, which is why, as a journalist, I'm not familiar with that particular word, I guess. But that will be for 9 through 12, and it's on their own through netbooks with different algebra classes and English classes, which will either let the students catch up or actually advance their skills ahead. And they will have some teacher contact there. That is also filled, over 60 students in that. Then there's a new one they have called the Summer Walk and Write, which after the, it's another two-week session, after the first day spent learning first aid, which tells you this is a fairly active class, they go glacier climbing and there's a rafting trip. And while they have the kids in the bus, they stick an iPod in their ear. And as they have them captive, they listen to geography of, say, the Susitna River.
This is high-tech summer school.
Oh, it's relentless. Then they go down the river, they get back, and they write about it. That's high school. Then they bring in middle school the next week, and the high school students then become mentor, and it operates on the you don't know it till you teach it premise. So that's pretty good. They're repeating.
And how long would this last? What, in
2 weeks.
The summer?
Two weeks.
So highly intensive for 2 weeks.
Yeah, and yet it doesn't interfere if the family's going to, the kids can still go to the family summer camp and learn the culture that way or be part of it. They have the camp camera at Denali. That's where 9 students go up for 3 days. This received some media attention last year. Photography, digital work, and they work with the park rangers. And my favorite, pre-K transition program for native boys, or for boys only, not girls. Now, gentlemen, if you think of yourselves at 4 years old, and maybe girls of the same age, who needed preschool training?
Four-year-old boys.
Four-year-old boys, yes. That runs the last half of July. That's the only one that still has space. These courses are extremely popular and extremely important to some of these kids who are coming in for the first time. 13 years ago, we had our own kids in the enrichment program, and it was a big help.
Great story. Len, that particular story is part of a series for KSK and APRN. Why don't you tell us about the series as a whole and some of the value it would have for listeners?
It's called the Alaska Native Education Series, and it's education in the broadest sense. almost parental in nature, because, you know, as a parent, we include anything. But it's you could get it, you could see the past ones. We've got about 40 already, at least over 40 posted on the APRN, Alaska Public Radio Network, website. You can go to that, scroll down, and you'll find a lot of stories about graduation rates, but you'll also find things related to health, some Talk of Alaska programs that dealt with Native health, Native Youth Olympics, West and Shifmref swap students, there's a swap of sorts, and one of my favorites, Urban Students Get Seminar on Seal Butchering. That's hands-on Native education there. And I think one
Did
of the-
Did cooking come with it?
Cooking? Well, I suppose, yeah, why not? I don't know. We'll have to go back and listen to the story, Michael.
That sounds like a great idea. You also had a story about a man named Aaron Leggett. Why don't you tell the listeners about Aaron?
That was a profile. There is also a series of profiles in this series, and Lori Townsend did one with Aaron. He's from Aklutna. He works for the Alaska Native Heritage Center as a cultural historian, 28 years old, so but he really knows it. And I think that piece is like a gateway to the others, because it's a young man. A lot of us know the familiar names of the Native leadership in the state, and we have other ideas of Anchorage Natives and Natives in general. But he really, really shows what it's like to be a Dena'ina in the area where your village and your lands has been historically taken over. His family fish camp was at Fish Creek, just off where Elevation 92 used to be, the restaurant.
This must have been a while ago.
Yeah. And precisely that, though. And then how the Dena'ina disappeared in this town, and the pride they get as they drive by the Dena'ina Center. It's a wonderful story. It's a great way. Start with Aaron, and then just spread out through the Native education website.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald, Brendan Joel Kelly, and Lynn Anderson. Steve, June 1 was the filing deadline for candidates for the legislature and those who are running statewide in the August primary. Mm-hmm. What did we learn at the last minute filing?
There are a few names that popped in there at the last minute. Scott McAdams, he is the mayor of Sitka, a Democrat. He signed on to take on Lisa Murkowski in the U.S. Senate race. He at first has to beat two candidates in the Democratic primary. Both of those candidates probably could be described as minor candidates, and McAdams probably has the inside edge, and then to take on Lisa Murkowski.
I believe the word we use in the media is gadfly.
I was being polite, Michael, yes.
Thank you.
But yeah, you're right. And you know, if you believe the polls, any Democrat who's going to go up against Lisa Murkowski in November will be the sacrificial lamb. So the hope is to get some name recognition, perhaps for a future run at a state office or even a federal office, I guess. But at least, too, the other thing, you know, he'll hold Senator Murkowski's feet to the fire and be an opponent. No one should just be getting a free pass, I think, to get back and get reelected. Another name that's familiar in Anchorage, Jack Powers. He runs Tudor Road Bingo. He signed up to run as a Democrat in the lieutenant governor's race. Said if he's elected, he'll only take $1, and he'll work like 12 hours a day or something to that effect. And he wants to almost diminish the role of the lieutenant governor in the state. And if you talk to some people, they say, how can he diminish it any further? But he wants to just make sure that there's no line of succession should something happen to the governor, that the lieutenant governor would automatically take over. You also have Dan Kendall, who's a familiar name. He was a member of the Anchorage Assembly for years. He was termed out of office, and now has filed to run for Nancy Dahlstrom's old seat, which encompasses Eagle River, the Air Force Base, the Army Base, and parts of Government Hill, I believe, in Mountain View. So he's running for that open seat in there. And a former city clerk, not a clerk, but she was a member of the, she helped oversee elections She signed up to run for a seat in the South Anchorage area as well. So some last minute people jump in.
Nice job. Thank you. Brendan, in your paper, you noted, the Anchorage Press, that there were a number of uncontested seats. How many in each house of the legislature and why?
There are 15 altogether. It seems like five Senate seats,
yes,
perhaps,
that's right.
And 10 House seats. And it's pretty evenly split. There's 8 Democrats and 7 Republicans who are running unopposed. And as far as some of them are Dennis Egan and Beth Catula down in Juneau, Les Guerra here in downtown Anchorage, John Coghill up in Fairbanks. I assume that the parties just decided it wasn't worth the resources to take on these well-established, well-known, popular incumbents. So it's a matter of the parties are really focusing on specific races. The Republican Party is looking to take on, looking to take over Senator Joe Thomas up in Fairbanks and Bill Willikowski here in Anchorage. They have this 10+2 campaign going on, and so they're really focusing on that. There's a lot of attention by the Democrats looking at Con Bundy's vacated seat, where you've got a three-way primary in the Republican side and Janet Reiser on the Democratic side. So they're really it's really targeted races as far
and
as
one thing we know
go.
From the past, when you have a lot of uncontested seats, it hurts turnout.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
Okay, and in the lieutenant governor's race, we now have Meade Treadwell has entered, and mm-hmm. he's running against Jay Ramirez, and Eddie Burke has a new way of campaigning. Why don't you tell us about that?
If you go to eddieburkeforalaska.com, I believe it is, Eddie's willing to go with you anywhere. You can go to, click the Take Eddie With You button on there, and you can fill out a form, and Eddie is offering, he will go to your company picnic with you. He will go to your grandma's house. He will go to your family reunion. He will go to meet your neighbors, go to your kids' soccer game. Eddie can go formal or Eddie can go casual. And I'm quoting directly from the website right now.
And somehow in your smile, I believe this is a new way of approaching campaigning.
It is.
Okay, turning to a much bigger issue. The oil spill in the Gulf continues to traumatize the Gulf and raise a whole lot of questions here in Alaska. You have a front page story in this week's press about research on
yes.
what might the consequences of a spill might be. In fact, much of it pushed by, or the attempts to gain more research by Meade Treadwell.
Yes.
Please tell us about that story.
Well, it's sort of predicated on a white paper that was just released. The one that I have is still marked draft, but it is the final version. And but the initial version had come out in February before the Gulf oil spill, and it basically details the absolute lack of research into what we would do if there was an Arctic oil spill. And this isn't just important because we've got over 600 active outer continental shelf leases right now, but also shipping lanes are opening up in the Arctic because of the sea ice is opening up. And Meade, in his position as outgoing chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, they prepared this report and basically said after the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, it was mandated that this ICOPR is the acronym, and I cannot remember. There were so
we'll
many acronyms in this research that makes one's head swim. But they were tasked with preparing a plan for an Arctic oil spill, and it is 2010, and there is no plan. So it suggests a number of things. Primarily, funding is a big issue, but also getting NOAA involved, because right now the Coast Guard is the chair of the committee that's supposed to come up with the plan.
But our politicians, we've heard a lot of, well, we're different up here. We know how to handle these things. This isn't like the Gulf of Alaska.
No. The conditions vary so much, and you've got to consider, is it pack ice? Is it shore ice? And you take a look at a project like BP's Liberty Project, which is going to be the world's largest directional drilling rig, and it's sitting on a gravel island and then drilling under. There's so many variables involved, and the only people who have really done any significant research on this are the Scandinavians. So we have a little bit of research. They did a three-year project between 06 and 09, but the U.S. hasn't taken a lead at all in this. And so hopefully, and the U.S. Arctic Research Commission is hoping that in the wake of the Gulf spill, this gets some serious attention as well as serious funding.
Lynn, you have a third story in your series that you did for, or that KSK did, on a charter school. Why don't you tell us about this charter school and what they've achieved there?
This is the unique one, and is quietly working along. Took a long time. It's a tribute to the effort of parents and other educators who were concerned with the Alaska Native student experience here. This is within the Arctic School District, or the Anchorage School District. But it is the only charter school which is minority. Most of the other charter schools have no minorities listed on their, they have students, but not enough to be on the No Child Left Behind. One does have.
Now, how many charter schools are there in our district?
There are a good half dozen. And this is the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School. And it tries to replicate or tries to work with a Native style of learning, more hands-on, also more within culture. You can count that if it's a certain level of math, it's going to involve berries in a myriad, a number of ways that I didn't know you could do so much math with berries.
No problems about if a train leaves Chicago and one leaves San Francisco.
But you do get the story problems in a cultural context, which in the past has been something that has been difficult for certain Alaska Natives. With the school, its strength is also its vulnerability. It's taking on students, who some of whom have come directly from the bush and so are adapting to an urban classroom, and it's taking on students who maybe had difficulty in a traditional classroom, so they're coming in. So along comes the annual No Child Left Behind rating. Well, they're still working with students who they're trying to adapt to a learning experience. But increasingly, this is the end of their second year now, they'll be their third year, they've had an extremely stable staff, no teachers left between the first and the second year, no classroom teachers, and they're honing the curriculum. And I talked to Carol Como yesterday in regards to the governor's vetoes and such, and happened to ask her, well, how do you think of the charter school? And she says, it is doing amazing work for, I mean, they had trouble finding a place. They had trouble at first luring students.
Where do they get their teachers?
They get their teachers from the district. And some of them both of them are extremely experienced. There's one who has national recognition, who last summer was invited out by invitation to a gathering in Washington, D.C. Their translator is superb and has done other translations beyond the education scene. It's really good. They'll have a new principal this year who has also been in Barrow for a number of years but is experienced within the district. And Carol's quite enthusiastic. She expects improvement across the board in the academics this year, and especially in math and science. Berries again.
Is there enough information to know what happens to these young people who are in this kind of a program?
We'll start to know. But other studies parallel, and this is also something getting back to the Title VII, show cultural awareness and cultural pride is a key ingredient to student success. And there have been some studies that show that in some cases with some Native children, cultural pride was actually more important to academic achievement than tutoring as an element. And what they're learning from this Native cultural school, Carol has said on other occasions, they're looking to find ways to apply it to the other ethnic and cultural groups.
And when they're 18 or they're high school seniors, what will they do?
They're all the hope they will walk across that stage.
Yeah, that's one of her favorite metaphors, I think, isn't it?
I thought it was mine.
Superintendent's, okay. let's get back to politics. I didn't think that we would get to this, but we're right into it right now. Brendan Joel Kelly, writer Joe McGinnis, moves into Sarah Palin's neighborhood, in fact, right next door to her, and it not only becomes a story, but it becomes a national story that you could watch on TV in many places and read in many publications. What do you think?
It's a win-win for each of them. I agree with what the Washington Post columnist, I think his name is Dave Weigel, who posted in a blog, Sarah's got to love this. She's the one that's posted photographs of Joe McGinnis up on her Facebook page, not vice versa. McGinnis hasn't posted any photos of when Todd supposedly came by the house. He says, I wanted to keep it quiet the entire time I was up here for the summer. And, you know, I don't quite believe that either. But they're both benefiting from the publicity. She's got her lovely pictures of that tacky
fence. And T.C. Mitchell of the Frontiersman's not benefiting from the publicity.
No, he's not. And I should note that the Frontiersman is our sister publication. But he made a mention of our state laws regarding when you can shoot a trespasser. And that did not go over so well. But it did get the Frontiersman on the Drudge Report.
It's the first time since the last time.
Yes, it's the first time since the last time.
Steve McDonald, moving in next to Sarah Palin. Journalistic endeavor or publicity stunt?
Both. Both, totally. And I'm not sure which one gets, probably publicity stunt probably gets more. I can't see Joe McGinnis going and knocking on the door and say, Sarah, can I ask you a couple of questions for the book? That's just not going to
Is this
happen.
Something so Channel 2 considered at a group meeting and decided not to, the moving in next to... former governor?
We stayed away from it, but then he wound up on the Today Show and said some pretty funny things. So we said, okay, we got to do it too. So we did the story.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you right here next week on Anchorage Edition. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.